Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the Shindig. I'm your usual host, Dr. Tom Horn, and it's brought to you by the Red River Archaeology Group. We've got another fantastic episode for you today. It's with Claire Boucher Sullivan, and she's talking about open air Irish rock art.
Of North Atlantic rock art in Ireland, it's fantastic. And I suppose, you know, it was an area that hadn't been, you know, studied in depth before.
So that's that amazing rock art you've seen. Maybe you think of the cup and ring marks. You'll see it on sort of essentially sort of boulders in the landscape or in the living rock. And it's something that's fascinated archaeologists and fascinated humans for thousands of years since the Neolithic.
Of course, they can include, you know, passage grave art that we have in Ireland and on the continent, and also, you know, the prehistoric North Atlantic rock art, which I would focus on.
Claire's research is fascinating because she's looking at how we protect these open air sites from natural, animal, you know, rains, threes, frost action, all the things you'd expect, you know, outdoor art to experience.
So do you know there are a lot of records of panels being blown up with dynamite, or do you know, going missing?
She's doing a lot of research into how we can protect these amazing open air ancient prehistoric art sites, and if you listen to the rest of this, I think you'll find that it's the art itself is fascinating, but the work that Claire and others are doing to preserve it is really just as interesting. Hi Claire, thanks so much for joining us today on Shindig. I think I'd just like to start with a really general question, because you know, we want to bring new people to archaeology and history, so I always like to start just the very sort of general sort of terms. So what in the most general terms is prehistoric rock art?
So I suppose rock art in general is any like images, carvings, drawings, or paintings on rock surfaces. And these vary dramatically from, you know, all corners of the globe. They can include the painted rock shelters in South Africa. They can include the rock art in Valcamonica in Italy, where there's multi-phase carvings. And then, of course, they can include, you know, passage grave art that we have in Ireland and on the continent, and also you know, the prehistoric North Atlantic rock art, which I would focus on. So it's very,
this is it. Very yeah. It's a very broad church. But you, as you're saying there, you focus on a specific form of it, and it's a form that I know, having in my commercial archaeology field digging days, I've wandered around misty hillsides of Scotland trying to find it. And just for our listeners to know, it's pretty difficult. I'm sure we'll get into with the effects of erosion and lichen and bog cover, that's very easy to miss stuff, even if you know kind of what you're looking for. So I suppose then we want to talk about Atlantic rock art, and that's your field of speciality. So what is Atlantic rock art? Where do you find it? And what sort of period and time are people carving these?
So Atlantic rock art, it's kind of characterized by its distribution along the North Atlantic coast. So you can find it in, you know, northern Spain and Portugal. So Galicia would be the most common place for it there. And then across the UK, and you know, in clusters across the island of Ireland, and I suppose it's mostly characterized by cup and ring motifs, and these cup and ring motifs kind of occur in variations, you know, and various different collaborations or various different patterns across the surfaces of these rocks. And I suppose there are some limited examples then of distinctive patterns in different valleys and different landscapes. You know, you would have kind of, you know, specific cup and ring motifs and variations of it that would be common throughout different landscapes. So yeah, I suppose that's kind of how you would characterize it.
So even though it covers this broad area, going from sort of Spain, sort of Portugal, I think sort of through Brittany and Britain and the island of Ireland, but you're saying they're almost like regional accents within it, then you get certain clusters of or particular styles of these cup and ring marks. And what other motifs are we finding? And I mean, just maybe explain a bit more about the cup and the ring marks and what other motifs that you're finding in these rock art.
Yeah, of course. Yes, there can be definitely, like, you know, in certain regions, I have noticed kind of a commonality between, like, you know, the reoccurrence of certain, you know, collaborations of these motifs on rock surfaces. And I suppose another really common motif would be a rosette motif, or, for example, cup and ring motifs with radial grooves. So that would be like, you know, and that there's actually variations in that also, you know, it could be like, you know, the cup mark is, you know, a hollow man-made depression, you know, surrounded by a pick marked normally or peck marked circular, you know, enclosing ring. And then sometimes the radial groove would come directly from the center of the cup mark, but sometimes it would come from, you know, the first outer ring, or, you know, there could be up to, you know, there could be any number of surrounding rings on, you know, on certain cup marks. You know, I've found up to like 8 and stuff like that, you know. So there's different variations, but, you know, to identify North Atlantic rock art, you know, it would be like some variation of the cup and ring radial groove, rosette, you know. So
I suppose, again, it's very easy for us as archaeologists to sort of to get into it. And before I sort of ask about, you know, sort of meaning and maybe how, you know, how this comes to be and how it comes to spread across this region, just back to the basic, this is just people with stone tools just chipping away at these exposed area of living rocks, a rock that's still part of the earth, if you will. Is that the impression that we should take away?
Yes. Well, I suppose what is distinctive about the North Atlantic tradition, especially like in Ireland specifically, is that the majority of these cup and ring motifs are found on boulders and outcrops, and they're often found, you know, the clusters of them are in quite rural settings. And, you know, so for example, just briefly, my study area was Cork and Kerry, and there'd be huge landscapes in Kerry where there'd be like any number of large boulders and outcrops, and they'd be sandstone, and the motifs would occur on the surface of those. So they would be like, you know, glacial erratics as opposed to kind of, you know, smaller stones.
All right. And it is just these are carved about 5,000 years ago. What's the period are we kind of talking about?
So I suppose that is, you know, it's impossible, as you know yourself, to date the art, as much as we'd love a specific date. I suppose it's late Neolithic, early Bronze Age is kind of the most favoured period of, you know, the creation of these panels. So I suppose, you know, again, it's impossible to get a specific date, but that would be the proposed theory that it would be. Do you know, there are, you know, some theories that would suggest it's earlier Neolithic and then, you know, into the early Bronze Age. So I suppose it is impossible to say, you know, the exact period, but I suppose I'd be definitely in the mindset that it was a little bit earlier than the early Bronze Age, you know, myself. So it'd be like late Neolithic.
Well, that's interesting. I the problem is, because so very few of them have actually been sort of excavated archaeologically, you know, the area around it. And we'll talk briefly later about the work that Blaise O'Connor did on one particular site in Ireland that maybe gives us some clues as to a sort of rough sort of dating parameter. But I think our listeners are sort of kind of aware, hopefully they've seen some images. They've maybe seen a map of the distribution. And I suppose, you know, as a sort of privilege of being the interviewer of this and talking to lots of interesting people, I sort of look at things in terms of networks and sort of Viking Age in terms of distribution, how things move around. And that often includes art styles as well as the actual objects and wells, if I'm looking at sort of jewelry or coinage. How do you think, does this spread, or is it, you know, is it one of these things like it's a sort of spontaneous response to particular stone types or climatic conditions? Or do you think there is maybe some sort of movement of people or trade or networks that are connecting these really sort of disparate groups of people?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting question. I suppose I wouldn't have a definitive answer, but just in terms of the distribution of the art in Ireland, it is so, you know, it's very very definitive in terms of, you know, the distribution. You know, there's the highest concentration is in Cork and Kerry, you know, Carlow, Wicklow, Louth, Monaghan, Donegal. So it is in clusters throughout the whole of Ireland. And then there are isolated examples elsewhere. You know, you could walk into a rural landscape and there could be over 100 examples, and then you could go to the next town over and find one. You could go to, you know, for example, the Mohill Stone is the only recorded example from Waterford. So it's you know, it's such an interesting distribution, I suppose, but there are clear, you know, there is clear evidence for, you know, the production of rock art in these specific landscapes.
Okay, so yeah. So we could sort of say we don't know. It could be a sort of spontaneous, but you know, with the mobility of people, one never knows, and that's something maybe for the distant future when we've got a lot more data. Yeah. But I won't press you on that now. But I will ask an equally difficult question early in the podcast. You know, people will be thinking, why? You know, why are they out in all conditions? You know, we both traipse the hills of Scotland and Ireland and valleys, finding these wonderful bits of art. And often weather conditions aren't good. Often the surrounding land is sort of boggy and peaty. And even with climatic change, you can imagine they weren't sort of tropical paradises back several thousand years ago. Why do you think so much resource, as we say as an archaeologist, why so much effort, if you will, has gone into creating these incredible motifs?
Well, I suppose, like, just, I mean, that's a tricky
I suppose I'm asking what are the theories that people have had. Whether you agree to them or not, in terms of why they're there, what is their meaning of them? Is it a language? Is it related to the movements of the seasons or the stars? Just anything like that. And I won't hold you to any of them, don't worry.
Okay, cool. Well, I suppose, you know, obviously, you know, as we can't date them and there's been limited excavation, I suppose it is. And, you know, these kind of prehistoric monuments, they're kind of, you know, open to interpretation, and, you know, interpretation in line with, you know, they could kind of fall into a number of different theories and, you know, tick a number of boxes. But I suppose the theory that I'd be, you know, most likely, you know, kind of, you know, I'd fall into the camp of, they were possibly boundary markers. Do you know, I suppose Avril Purcell did a study and very much in line with some of Richard Bradley's teachings and theories on how these panels kind of occur, you know, and the different positioning and in situ positioning of them across the landscapes would kind of, you know, imply that they could be boundary markers. Avril Purcell did say that some of the more elaborate panels were kind of on higher landscape positioning in these mountainous regions, and maybe they were reserved for certain members of the society. And you know, maybe the ones that were less elaborate were, you know, designed for other members of the societies. But I suppose, again, like, you know, we only have you know, there are so many landscapes left to be explored. So I suppose, you know, that's a great theory. You know, and I would think it would be something along those lines. But, you know, I suppose there's so much left to be discovered that it's impossible to have a definitive, you know, a definitive theory forever right now. Yeah.
And I think that's one of the joys of archaeology, that I think I was saying in another podcast, you know, we're, you know, at best, even for the sort of more historic or proto-historic periods that I do, we're only going to get 0.00000001 of the evidence. So when you're taking that back, you know, thousands and thousands of years, you can understand why I've been reading some of your really interesting work. And we'll give out links to your work and other talks that you've done, that you're sort of talking about. You know, what you actually have to do is look at it in terms of landscape, look at it in terms of boundaries, and try and look at where these sit. So you might be doing lots of landscape analysis. And do you do things like viewshed analysis on any of these, or has anyone done that? Is that an area that people are sort of looking into?
Yes, Caitlin O'Neill, actually, her thesis, her master's thesis from 2019, she did that. She did that, and she also looked at the different like paleo environments of, you know, these prehistoric landscapes. So that was kind of her, where she was coming at it from. And Avril Purcell also, that was kind of her one of her main objectives in her thesis, was to kind of look at it from the, you know, kind of map the layout and the in situ positions of the panels. So there has been a little bit of work done on that, I suppose. Caitlin O'Neill's the paleo environment study, that was kind of, you know, that's kind of very, very new and very, you know, the way she can, you know, I suppose use the software available and, you know, the different archaeological software programs that can help her kind of, you know, get some kind of feeling of what the landscape was like, and, you know, kind of develop new theories and kind of, you know, shed new light on these situations. So it's great.
And I suppose now we've got a bit of a more general understanding, I really want to now ask you about your research. So, you know, this question will involve me asking you, you know, where do we find the rock art in Ireland? You talk about this sort of concentrations, just a sort of reminder to the audience of where that is. And yeah, and just the regions that you study, and maybe, yeah, just your reasons behind doing that.
So I suppose how I really got into the whole you know, the rock art side of things was I did my dissertation for my BA on passage grave art. And then through that, I kind of, you know, researching that, I found these other papers and, you know, these other references to a different kind of art, which I had no knowledge of, or, you know, wasn't as kind of widely studied. And I kind of was just intrigued by it. So then when I went to do my research master's, I suppose I kind of looked at, with my supervisor and Professor William O'Brien, we kind of looked at different landscapes and, you know, where I would base, you know, my research on this. So we looked at areas that hadn't been like highly studied before. So there was some viewshed analysis, there was some, you know, there were different aspects of this rock art considered before, but not since Avril Purcell's, you know, fantastic study of Derry na Blatha in the early 2000s. And prior to that, it was Fionnuala Finlay in the 70s. Of this particular Cork and Kerry south-west landscape. So we kind of took a different approach and we looked at the conservation of this. And I suppose to have, as part of this study, then it was, you know, to get a body to look at, a body of study, a kind of a, you know, a good collection of panels to kind of assess for the thesis. I had to compile a catalogue of 100 plus panels, and they were then in the southwest region. So, so that's kind of how we decided on those landscapes. And then, you know, to pick the particular landscapes, I suppose, you know, the Derry na Blatha was, and Derrini, they're probably the most two, you know, they're right next to each other, those townlands, and I suppose they're probably the most well-known rock art landscapes in Kerry up until very recently. And I think now, like on the opposite side of the Iveragh Peninsula, there are the townlands of Cuma Saharan, Letter West and Keel Duff Upper, and I think they are quickly becoming the arguably the highest concentration of rock art in Ireland at the moment. So it's really great how it's kind of all unraveling. Like, there are other researchers and enthusiasts, you know, discovering new panels there, and so it's great. So I think I picked the right area to study.
And it's excellent. You know, if we show up one of your distribution maps, you can see that concentration. This is, you know, as Claire's alluding to there, this is not an accident. There are a lot. The people in that area are very, you know, even accounting for the fact that there's a lot more to find, you suspect that that's an overall density is not going to change massively. So this is a real locus of this sort of form of activity. So I can absolutely understand you sort of focusing on that area. But within that, you mentioned the word conservation, and that's really your kind of area of expertise, isn't it? It's looking at how these are degraded, either by human, animal, natural, climate action, and, you know, how that changes over time, and maybe what we can do to help preserve them. So can you just give everyone just a little bit of an idea? You know, I also say that it's a classic 2-minute elevator pitch of, if you're explaining your interest in the conservation of these sites and of these wonderful stones, you just sort of tell the listener and the viewer what your work is.
Yeah, so I suppose my work is on the conservation of the panels. So because there are so many, we have, you know, so many, you know, fantastic examples of North Atlantic rock art in Ireland. It's fantastic. And I suppose, you know, it was an area that hadn't been, you know, studied in depth before. And it's definitely, you know, I found, you know, it was very appealing to me and to my supervisor also. And I suppose what we're looking at in terms of conservation is, you know, the state of the rock art, and what really comes into play here is, you know, the earlier accounts, the antiquarian accounts, the antiquarian drawings, the antiquarian rubbings of the surface, and they're invaluable in this study, as, you know, they're kind of your base, you know, where you base your analysis on. So, like, you know, for example, you know, you could have a fantastic drawing of a panel from, like, you know, the early 20th century. And then, you know, you go to look at that panel and it's so badly weathered and eroded that it's difficult in some cases to even say, you know, you're really, is that the, and you know, in rock art, it's like, is that the right rock? That's kind of, you know, a common thing anyway. But, like, you know, you really are like, feck, is that the right one? Do you know? So I suppose that's kind of what I'm looking at. And you know, kind of looking at these elements that do, you know, that cause damage and destruction to the surface of the panels.
And then what are, I mean, I've said that the animals and humans are all very, very vague, but what are the sort of biggest threats to this Atlantic rock art at the moment?
Okay, so I suppose we do have the National Monuments Act, which is great in terms of, you know, the human, the protection, the like legislation and provisions for, you know, the protection of our national monuments. But I suppose prior to that, you know, because the rocks were so big, they were so large, and you know, the larger ones sometimes had fantastic and elaborate motifs on them. But, you know, back in the, you know, the 1800s and 1900s, they were in a farmer's way. You know, he was trying to plant crops. He was trying to, you know, rear animals, and there was this giant rock in the middle of the field that was of no use to him, and he obviously didn't understand the significance. So, you know, there are a lot of you know, there are a lot of records of panels being blown up with dynamite, or, you know, going missing, right. You know, only found in someone's ditch in a few different pieces. Do you know, there are examples of that. So, you know, unfortunately, like in some cases, it's great because we do have earlier accounts of these, even though we can no longer find the panel in situ. But, you know, if the earlier accounts is really great, because at least we have a record then and a rough idea of its in situ landscape of, like, you know, what townland it was in. So then, you know, as time goes on and greater studies kind of happen, you know, we'll have an idea of you know, roughly where the panels were. But, you know, human, I suppose, would be a big factor. Do you know, there are cases of vandalism, whether intentional, unintentional. Do you know, people might not, the biggest thing I think is awareness. So to bring awareness of rock art, because, you know, for example, if people didn't know what it was, they could go out and they could, you know, carve their initials. I found it a few times, people's initials carved into the rock. But I know, yeah, but like, it's kind of I've been like, oh god. But you know, I've found that, and do you know, it's obviously, it's a little bit heartbreaking. But, you know, in some instances, half the panel is covered in, you know, in blanket peat. So maybe they didn't see the art, maybe they didn't, you know, really know the significance. It could have, you know, it's kind of just highlighting the significance, even though, you know, we don't specifically know the exact meaning and significance behind it. You know, trying to preserve, you know, to preserve the art will kind of, you know, in time, you know, hopefully we'll yield some more theories on that. But I think human interaction and you know, protection from human agency is really, really important. And, you know, through raising awareness, that's kind of what we hope to do.
And we're certainly going to talk a bit more about that later. But, you know, everyone knows, thinks about climate change. Mm-hmm. And I imagine that will affect, you know, it's known as open air Atlantic rock art, so it faces all the threats 24 hours a day. What are the sort of long-term sort of climatic threats to rock art, and then maybe what are the more sort of recent sort of human changes to the climate that are affecting these panels?
Yeah, okay, so I suppose globally the number one threat to rock art, any kind of rock art all over the world, is rainwater, and we certainly know all about that here in Ireland. So I suppose, do you know, between you know, the rainwater and specifically freeze thaw action during my study out in Letter West, I brought a lovely geologist with me to kind of look at the surface of the panels and kind of help me identify the main causes of this natural weathering. And he did notice on a number of the panels that freeze thaw action was definitely at play. I suppose what happens basically is when it rains and the temperatures are cold, which we also know about here in Ireland, the rainwater freezes in the cracks and the joints within the rock surface, and then that causes them to expand by up to like 10%. So eventually that weakens the rock and then will cause some of the rock surface to break away. So that will, I know it doesn't, oh sure, it's only a little bit, like it's only 10%, but over time then, we will lose an awful lot of the surface carvings, So that's kind of a big one. Apart from that, there is, microflora such as lichens and, like blanket peat. And with lichen, for example, I also dragged a poor lichenologist with me out to who I didn't bring to Kerry with me to look at rocks, but there's a lichenologist came with me, and he identified a number up to a couple of hundred different species of lichen on the surface of some of the panels. And that did obviously worry me slightly when he was saying, oh, that's an aggressive one. And I learned a lot about lichens, but what we looked at a number of panels in the study area, and what we really did notice, and which was as a relief to me, was that most of the lichens were slow growing. So they would have been there for hundreds of years, and the damage that they're causing compared to modern, if we were to peel it all off and let it grow back, you have pesticides in the air from the surrounding farmers. There's an awful lot of other elements that, would impact and would, create a more damaging form of lichen on the panel surface. So I think it was best that, it's a good thing, but it's not a good thing. But, it's better than what we could have now, So I suppose, doing the photogrammetry and the laser scanning and stuff on the surfaces of the panels, we can kind of see underneath the microflora, so we can identify some of the art without kind of disturbing the surface, and just leaving the microflora as it is, because it's a less harmful option in this case,
And that's it. Your work is sort of notable for its sort of innovative use of all the non-invasive techniques that you may have heard of. Claire's just mentioned photogrammetry and also laser scanning. So for people who don't really know so much about archaeology but are interested in what it is and its future and current sort of developments in using technology, could you tell us a little more? So if you've got a panel of this beautiful rock art, what are you doing then? What is photogrammetry doing, and what is laser scanning doing that's different, and how does it let you see things without, as you say, scraping off lichen or the blanket bog?
Yeah, well, I suppose with blanket bog, you're kind of stuck in terms of the laser scanning and stuff. It wouldn't be able to, you wouldn't get a, you'd have to kind of remove that if you were to scan it, and that's kind of against, I suppose, the best practice. So with regard to the lichen, photogrammetry was the first kind of one of those that I employed the new technologies. And photogrammetry is actually fantastic. I'm a huge believer in preservation by record. I think it's fantastic. I think it's what we need to go for in the future. I definitely think it's absolutely brilliant. And with regard to the rock art, it's so accessible, photogrammetry. It was employed in the Northumberland Rock Art, or the Northumberland Durham Rock Art Project, where people recorded panels. Basically what it is you can go out to a piece of rock art, and you have a camera, it doesn't have to be super, super high quality, just a normal kind of good enough camera. And you can take, the way I did it was, you can take photographs of the panel from, further away, then a little bit closer, then closer again, and different parts of the rock art. And then you can get like ArcGIS or any other kind of, photogrammetry software, upload your images, and it will create a model of the panel for you. And then this, you know, there'll be a mesh and a model, and you'll be able to identify then on this model, you know, for example, hollows, circular hollows, grooves that you may not have seen with the naked eye. So it's great. And then you'll have that, like, you know, that record there. So if anything was to happen to the panel, or, you know, if you had to cross-reference, if you saw, you know, you'd have that record there, and it's so easily accessible, and you can upload it then to, you know, any online portals, or make it accessible to people that may not have, you know, that may not be able to go out to the field to see it. So then again, that would be kind of, you know, reiterating the awareness and raising more awareness around it. And then I suppose laser scanning would be kind of a more intense version of this. So I suppose myself and the archaeology department in UCC went out with the laser scanner to record a number of panels also. And I think the most, yeah, so I suppose this is great. I love laser scanning as well. I think it's fantastic in terms of, you know, the visibility. I know photogrammetry is fantastic, but obviously laser scanning just gives you that bit more detail. So I suppose it really does showcase the full extent of the carvings and the motifs on the panel surface. It's really, really great. And again, those models can be uploaded to any, you know, online portals, or made accessible to anyone who would, you know, who would not necessarily have access to them. But they are great tools for preserving by record. And again, photogrammetry is so accessible that it can be, you know, employed in a number of like community projects, or even just by enthusiasts. And then that will add to our understanding and to the overall archaeological record, which is fantastic.
And yeah, you know, it's because it's clear, sort of talking about photogrammetry and laser scan models, you think to the website Sketchfab, which I know that you're certainly using, many people are aware of. But you know, for non-archaeologists out there, or people who are maybe not been to this website, it's where lots of archaeologists upload their projects, and you can get these amazing 3D scans that you can sort of turn around as 3D models, and you can look at the detail and you can zoom in and out. A lot of them are annotated as well. A lot of them are sort of linked to certain projects, so you'll have a whole range. So you might have a whole range of ones at rock art, or if you're looking at early medieval sculpture, there'll be ones there. So it's a great resource for just the general public to look at what really skilled archaeologists like Claire are doing. And you were talking there about preservation by record as being your sort of number one thing as a way of recording. It's something that, you know, the sort of citizen archaeologists can do themselves. You know, everyone listening to this can get involved. But what are the I know you in your work you talk about sort of the other ways of doing it as well. You've talked about legal, maybe expand a wee bit on that, but also there are some in museums, there are some that are protected by sort of cattle grids, because livestock rubbing against stones as an early medievalist as well, I'll tell you that's an issue. And I imagine it's the same for prehistoric zones. So how, you know, I suppose I'm asking, how do we protect Atlantic rock art? So, you know, you've mentioned some of them, but maybe just talk a bit more of these in terms of museums, is it physical barriers and ways of doing it like that?
Yeah, so I suppose there have been a few examples, you know, that I've come across in the study area that do have actual physical barriers in place to protect the panels from cattle or, you know, from livestock, which is great to see. Do you know, it is great, but I suppose the majority, again, are just in my study area, are just in these massive, huge, like massive landscapes of, you know, rural landscapes. And, you know, to try and preserve every single one of those from mountain sheep or from goats, or which would be, you know, common in the area, it would be nearly impossible. And again, just with some of the more natural agencies, for example, like, you know, blanket peat would, you know, cover some of these surfaces, but now it's receding, which is how we're finding the new panels. And what happens is, although it preserves the panel, it also like leaches, you know, some of the rock. It leaches the rock, leaving the surface quite delicate. So then if you've hoofed animals walking over it, then, you know, it'll definitely weaken the surface. So it is hard in terms of trying to preserve individual panels in rural landscapes like that. But it is really, really great to see the initiatives taken by some landowners, you know, to preserve the panels. And, you know, they kind of have an awareness and an understanding of these panels. And And do you know, even whether, even if it's not like, because there are a lot of panels actually that do have some folklore around them, or you know, some you know, story. And you know, I know, like, from coming from a scientific aspect with the thesis, I have to also like admire the way that there is, you know, this kind of folklore attached to it, because it does give, whether it's right or it's not right, or you know, whatever way you want to look at it, I suppose it gives the awareness and it gives the importance to these monuments to continue to be protected, you know. So I suppose that's another way, that's another thing then that you would come across. But I suppose in terms of the actual physical barriers, there are cattle grids, there are sometimes, you know, fences around them, and that is, that's really, you know, where possible, that's great to see, you know.
And I know you, I imagine you'll be a purist, and open air in your research is probably a clue, but what do you think about the approach that you do get? And I've seen it in my early medieval world as well, when the you start to put a glass case around it, or in some cases they're sort of removed indoors entirely to museums. I imagine that's, you know, that's, is it a horses for courses sort of thing? You know, for certain stones, that's the best way of looking after them. Do you just see it as a case by case basis, or are you very much, if it can be, stay out, you know, where it is originally, so we can get that idea of where it is in the landscape, that's the most important thing for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, for example, like I definitely be of the mindset where leave it where it is, so that we can get a full idea of, you know, the in situ landscape and try and understand the distribution. You know, because I think removing the panels from their in situ position, like unnecessarily, you know, is just, I'd be very much against that. But I suppose in some cases where you have panels that may be at risk, or panels that have been found not in their in situ position, for example, like the Mohill Stone, you know, to take that in and to preserve that, because, you know, I really like that initiative. I really think that's great when museums and you know, other local authority or any other bodies that do, you know, identify the importance of these panels and do say, well, look, they need to be on display, they need to be safeguarded. I think that's fantastic. But actually removing panels from their in situ location, that, oh no.
And I suppose that we're talking about in situ. So, I mean, I'm going to ask you this question about going back to the Blaise O'Connor research, which was fantastic. And then I'll follow that up with asking you about maybe your a case study or a favorite case study of yours in terms of what's on the stone, and maybe you know, how you recorded it, if you sort of used any new methods. But so I'll start the first part of that question then, if we're just going back to, because we mentioned it earlier, that's one of the very few, and maybe the only rock art site in Ireland that's had a sort of full archaeological excavation around it, and also found what we think is sort of contemporary archaeological material. Could you tell us a little bit more about that that site in County Monaghan, please?
Yes, so Blaise O'Connor, it is the only excavation that took place in Ireland on a rock art site, and it was formed part of Blaise O'Connor's thesis, PhD thesis, which is just fantastic, and it's such a valuable research resource for other rock art researchers and for archaeologists in general. It's just such a fantastic contribution, and yeah, it's the first and only, as of now, excavation of a rock art site. And I suppose up in Louth and Monaghan, that would be one of the highest concentrations of rock art also. And yeah, Blaise did an excavation there, and she found like a number of like stone lined pits, and she found beads, and she found a number of other artifacts. And I suppose, just, you know, it'd be great to kind of see some more excavations or more initiatives around that throughout the country. And you know, I think it's fantastic to have that, and it's just brilliant. And I know that there are excavations elsewhere, you know, in the world on rock art sites, but it would be great, especially with the increasing number of rock art panels that have been discovered in the southwest. It would just be fantastic to see an excavation like that, or you know, to take place there, especially in, you know, in on the Iveragh Peninsula, which would be like the highest concentration of art at the moment.
And, you know, if, you know, I'll say this to many archaeologists, if funding weren't a problem, which either micro region, you're right to laugh. If funding weren't a problem, which site or which, you know, valley would you concentrate your resources on? If you could excavate either an area or a particular outcrop or even a particular panel, And do you have any candidates? I suppose I'm sort of asking, maybe I'm getting into the foothills of like, what is your favorite, or what site do you think is most promising in all your research?
Okay, well, I have to say that's absolutely hands down. That is Letter West. Letter West is a townland on the Iveragh Peninsula, and it has neighbouring townlands of Cuma Saharan and of Kielduff Upper. And the analysis on those panels actually dates back to, you know, the early 20th century and possibly before it. So, you know, there are those three townlands that are three neighbouring townlands, and the art there is just absolutely phenomenal. That's where the pieces in Letter West specifically, that's where the Blanket Peat is you know, kind of God, my brain. And the Blanket Peat is you know, starting to reveal more panels, and it's really, really becoming kind of the rock art capital. Really, I know there are panels in Donegal and stuff and the Inishowen Peninsula, and I know there are fantastic examples being revealed there, but I have to say, obviously, just because, you know, slightly biased from my research, that the Letter West townland is just absolutely amazing. It's just breathtaking. And do you know, when you look at it from, you know, a prehistoric times, they weren't divided into three townlands, so it was just one specific area. So when you think about that, like, you go into Letter West, and unfortunately at the moment there's a water filtration system or center on the land, which is kind of, you know, it's a bit of an eyesore when you look at these stunning landscapes. And it's basically like an amphitheater of hills, and there's lakes, and I'd live there, like, you know, it's just gorgeous. But it's just stunning. You could spend days and days and days just, you know, walking around it and look, like, everywhere you look there's a piece of fantastic, like, really elaborate rock art. So it's great. So I would 100% Letter West on the Iveragh Peninsula definitely needs an excavation. So if anyone wants to give us funding.
Yes, we will emphasize this point in the program. Please give archaeologists more funding to go to beautiful parts of the world and do archaeology. But that sounds an amazing. You've done the work for Visit Ireland for you as well. I want to go there now and have a look. So, you know, that's a project you'd like, you know, ideally like to do in the future. What, again, you've talked about a few of them, like Northumberland and Durham. What other amazing projects are out there? Because there are ones in Scotland as well. Yes. Are there ones that you could tell people that they can maybe get involved in or go to their websites?
Yes, well, the Scottish Rock Art Project that just concluded, I think, at the end of last year, well, that is just absolutely amazing. And Joanna Valdez and her team did some amazing work there. It's just absolutely fantastic. And it's great to see these initiatives, you know, across Europe and specifically the Scottish Rock Art Project. I 100% recommend people to visit their website and you know, check it out, because it's just so well worth a look, and it really does showcase what fantastic art and what great archaeologists are, you know, after revealing there.
And I suppose we're sort of getting to the end now, and you know, we will give out links to you're on Instagram, you're on, it was called Twitter, it's now called X. You're also, you've got a website as well. I'll let you give out those links. Are there any other resources? I believe sort of archaeology.ie is a good place to look at. Yes. A map if you're wanting to find them. So if I've been, as I'm sure, you know, everyone listening to this will be enthused by, if they want to find out more about rock art in Ireland, you know, today, what web resources are there for them to sort of have a look at?
Yes, so I suppose archaeology.ie would be the main one in terms of, you know, the location and the distribution of the rock art. So archaeology.ie, if you go onto that, you can type in your townland, your county, and what kind of monument that you're looking for. So you could put in Kerry, Letter West, rock art, and you can click go, and it would basically tell you the coordinates of these panels. And it's great because there's a lot of work being done there at the moment, and also you know, because there's some of these panels have such, you know, historic records, that the National Monument Service, actually, some of them, when you click on them, it'll show you the historic records and all the references for those panels. So it's a really great resource, and also then it will help people that might have stumbled across something new, a new piece of rock art, or, you know, they kind of want to double check if it's been recorded or not. If you go onto archaeology.ie and kind of cross-reference, you know, what you found yourself to do you know, the panel in front of you, or what you found yourself to the panel on the archaeology.ie, you'll be able to kind of, you know, like work out whether it's a new panel or whether it's something that's been previously recorded.
And yeah, that's as well. I mean, you, because you're not just online, you've written chapters in books, and you've written a guide that people can download as a PDF, as I did myself. Could you tell people a bit more about anything else that they, you know, they love your work, they want to read more stuff specifically by you?
Yes, so I suppose the Heritage Council, I was really, really fortunate, and I'm very grateful to have had the opportunity to work with the Heritage Council here in Ireland. So the Heritage Council are just fantastic. They fund some amazing projects. They really help community archaeology. They really help adopt a monument. They have a program, Adopt a Monument. The head of conservation, Ian Doyle, he's just an absolutely, you know, he's fantastic. And he really is. He encourages so many community groups. And, you know, they really do help with the preservation and kind of the promotion of archaeology. And I did write a PDF online with them a few years ago on, you know, a little, like, it was our ancient landscapes, prehistoric rock art in Ireland. So what it did was really just give readers kind of an overview and a background to prehistoric rock art in Ireland with a view to creating awareness and hopefully then in turn creating, you know, having more higher levels of conservation and understanding.
And it's also got some amazing photographs in it. Could you give us just the details of the photographer who's sort of known for amazing photographs of the rock art, that you get to see rock art, but they've got beautiful wildlife and backgrounds in it as well. I could give some more information on that.
Yeah, Ken Williams, he's Shadows and Stone, if anyone wants to see some amazing images. He's fantastic. He's a fantastic photographer. I first worked with him back in 2015 when I curated an exhibition on prehistoric rock art in the Cork Public Museum. And it was, he's just great to work with, and his work is just amazing. So I'm delighted that his photographs were included in that publication. But yeah, Shadows and Stone, if anyone is looking to look at more of Ken's work.
They are absolutely gorgeous photographs. The art's beautiful. The background, the sort of slightly confused looking cows in them are great as well. But absolutely, if nothing else, this podcast combined with that PDF, we'll give out the links with all the images in it and Ken's work as well as Claire's work. You've also written a chapter as well or signaling and performance book. Yes. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, so I suppose Aaron Mazel and George Nash, they're based in the UK. Aaron is associated with Northumberland University or Newcastle University, and they're both fantastic researchers in the field of rock art, and they have established BRAG, the British Rock Art Group, and that's, I suppose, how I first met them. And BRAG then, I suppose, has an annual conference where researchers from across the globe can go and present their research, you know, on different aspects of rock art. And, you know, that's how I first met them. And I know Aaron he's from Cape Town, and he did his research on rock art in South Africa and conserving it. So it was really great to talk to somebody from a different part of the world doing a similar project when I was completing mine. So it was great. Aaron and George are just fantastic. And BRAG, if anyone fancies, even if you're not an archaeologist or a rock art researcher, it's well worth a visit to one of the BRAG conferences, because there's just so much. We had recently, it was Charlotte Van Dome Gardner, who's looking at flute player imagery in Native American art. You can have anything from that to, you know, the hills of Kerry to, you know, rock art on the continent and in, you know, the Middle East and, you know, Eastern Europe. It's great. It's a wide variety, and anyone that's interested in rock art should definitely try and grab a BRAG conference at some point.
And you were just recently talking at one of, would you like to just tell us a little bit about the talk that you gave there?
Well, I had hoped to be attending that. Unfortunately, my flight was cancelled last minute, but I know, yeah. But I had prepared a presentation on the Mohill Stone. So the Mohill Stone, I currently work in tourism in Waterford. So I suppose trying to find the balance between marketing and conservation now is at, you know, it's at its finest. So I suppose I kind of picked the example of the Mohill Stone in Waterford, the only example of rock art in the region. And I suppose it kind of has an interesting history in terms of there was a researcher, Susan Johnson, and like I think it was the 90s, I may be wrong, but I'm fairly sure it was the 90s or the 80s, that was overlooking from the States, and she was doing research on rock art here in Ireland. And she kind of released a paper, you know, three problematic stones from Ireland, and she couldn't locate the Mohill Stone. And then Elizabeth Shee actually managed to locate the stone. It was on display in the stone corridor in UCC. So it had actually been removed, and, you know, it had been put on display in the stone corridor. So it's an interesting panel, and anyone who's interested in, you know, checking out the stone corridor, there are a few examples of rock art down there in UCC, as well as Ulm stones. So it's a really good spot.
Yes. And if there's anywhere there's a corridor of carved stones from whichever period, I think any archaeologist or anyone interested in history in the past will need to go and see. And well, I think, you know, that's a great place to end this. I think we've all learned so much. I mean, I do obviously some as much research as I can into these, and I read your stuff, and I've listened to some of your talks, but your enthusiasm for it really, really came across. And I mean, I think hopefully you do get that million euro grant and can spend a few years looking at your dream sites. You certainly deserve it with the amazing work and all the outreach that you do. And thank you from behalf of the Red River Archaeology Group and the Shindig and our producer Luke and myself for talking with us today. And best of luck in the future, and hopefully we'll get you on again.
Thanks so much for having me, guys. I really enjoyed it, and it's great to talk about rock art.
As I you know, said in the intro, that, you know, it's fascinating, and it's not often we see, because, you know, we've talked in a lot of these podcasts about, you know, the research and the actual history and archaeology of an artifact or a range of artifacts, but to talk to someone that's looking at how it will still be preserved for future generations is something we've not really had before.
Yeah, it's interesting, and it's, again, like I say this a lot, it's very much in keeping with what we're trying to do here, preserving things for a next generation, telling these stories. Kind of, I suppose for myself, I'm on a massive learning journey with these things, because I know nothing about any of the subjects we're talking about. And I hope that there are people listening and watching who also are interested, but maybe don't know a whole lot, as well as some experts and people who, like yourself, who know an awful lot about these things. Because I'd love for people listening to the Shindig or watching the Shindig to be coming along on the journey with me and learning an awful lot along the way as well, like I did with this episode and all the previous ones, which you can listen back to.
Yeah, and I mean, Luke's saying there, I learned a lot as well, because the preservation is not something I know so much about myself. So, you know, every day is a school day, and if Claire's your teacher, you know, you'd actually look forward to going to school.
That's the thing. I love when we get people on who love to talk about, and most people we get on love to talk about their, I suppose, chosen subject. And Claire was somebody who was absolutely amazing at doing that. And you can see the passion, the love she has for it, and how engaged she is with it. And that's amazing. It's great to see.
And I'll just say thank you for listening. Thanks again to Claire. And as ever, leave it to Luke, because Luke remembers all the bits that I forget at the end of a podcast.
Make sure to subscribe to us, guys, if you want us to, if you want to keep getting us into your ears every 2 weeks, filling you up with loads of historical facts and amazing archaeology. Hit subscribe, hit follow, follow us on YouTube, on Spotify, on Apple Podcasts. Maybe look us up on Twitter or X or whatever it's called this week. Follow us on Instagram, on Facebook. We'd love to hear from you. If you have anything interesting that you'd like to show up on the Shindig, drop us a DM, at us anywhere you see us. We'd love to hear from you. We have some great stuff coming up in the future. So make sure to hit subscribe, hit rate, hit review, and tell some people about us, because we'd love to spread this around.
Agreed with all of that. And thank you. And we'll see you next time.
Thanks, guys.